The following show is dedicated to Mia Park and Barbara Yang. The views expressed on the following show may not be those of the hosts, guests, or WSPN Skidmore Radio. Talk Saratoga is produced by Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated and may not be reproduced in part or in whole unless expressed written approval is given. Now, here are the hosts of Talk Saratoga, Rick Thompson and a Saratoga All-Star.
Good morning and welcome to Talk Saratoga and this, not snowy day, and I don't think it was as cold as they said it was going to be, although it's going to get colder as the day goes along. And today, don't forget, is Chowder Fest in downtown Saratoga, and tomorrow night is the Super Bowl. So you can stack up on your chowder today and have it tomorrow night. Anyway, I want to introduce a guest today who's he's a really nice guy, and I like to have him on the show as much as I can, although the years go by and we don't get to see him too much, but I really enjoy him. Alan Richer, who's known as the Toga Chip Guy, and he leads a fantastic life, very interesting, he's one of a kind. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning. Nice to be here again. Nice to see you, Rick.
It's great to see you, as always. It really is. We played a song by Barry White, who I don't know if he had anything to do with chips, but you have a story about him.
You know, when I used to go visit my cousin who lived out in the San Fernando Valley, which is a suburb of L.A., and Barry White used to live next to my cousin. He was the next-door neighbor. And Barry White was always having these parties, it seemed like every night, and there would be, you know, hundreds of cars there. And we always got annoyed because we never got invited. You see all these beautiful women and everything coming to the parties, and we always felt left out. So
did you ever meet him?
No, I mean, I would see him sometimes, but we never got invited. You know, was sort of shy. Wasn't going to go up and say, you know,
right,
what about us?
But today you would, probably.
Yeah, today I would have been a little bit more aggressive.
Yeah, I know. As growing up, I was shy, too. But, yeah, I used to see him on talk shows and that, and he was really neat. I mean, he was a real funny guy, and I don't know who it was, if it was Johnny Carson or that, wanted to know how he did with girls in school, and he said, really good because of his voice. Yeah, so deep voice. And I don't know, girls must like deep voices, I guess. But
I know, I was watching a thing of Johnny Carson interviewing Sinatra, and he said, when you wanted to make it out with a girl, whose music did you listen to?
That's Tony Bennett, probably. That's funny. So why don't you start out? I know you've been interviewed by so many people, and you've done so many things. Why don't we let you take it over, and you just go on what you want to talk about?
Well, sure. I was saying that one story that people don't know about me, when I was I went undergrad and to law school at Syracuse University, and that school is known for having produced some of the greatest sportscasters, Marv Albert, the grandfather of all of them, Marty Glickman, Bob Costas, who I went to school with. Mike Tirico, Dick Stockton, on Iron Eagle. And I wanted to go out for the as a freshman, because in high school I had been the sports editor of my high school newspaper in Clark, New Jersey. And I wanted to go out, and it was really difficult. So at the time, they had a All-American defensive tackle football player. His name was Joe Ehrman. And he was he would not really talk to the press or anything. So they said to me, and I didn't realize this background, they said, if you can get an interview with Joe Ehrman, you can be on the paper. So it's sort of an impossible task. So I didn't know what to do. So I went down at the time to the old Manly Fieldhouse, and that's where they had the locker rooms and everything for the football practice. And he was 6'7", and I think like 280 pounds.
Oh, yeah.
And he came out, and I was a scrawny kid. I probably weighed like 140 or something. And he came out naked out of the shower, and I went up to him and I said, you know, I used to look like you too before I started working out. And he thought that was funny. And then I told him that, you know, I had gotten this challenge, and if I could get an interview with him, I could make the paper. So he gave me the interview, so I made the paper, which was very unusual for a freshman.
Right.
And then my biggest story was I lived in Lawrenson, and one of my people who lived on my floor, he worked security at the War Memorial, which was the arena downtown.
Right.
And what happened was he said to me that there's this guy who's going to get some award, and his longtime friend is Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. And nobody knows it's going to be a big surprise, so there's no publicity, but he's going to come out and surprise them. And he said, you know, if you come down, like, he's going to be in his back room for like an hour waiting, and I'll see if I can get you back there, maybe, and get an interview. So I'm a freshman in college, and I didn't really have a suit or anything, so I put on a shirt and tie and a sweater, and everybody goes, where are you going? I said, I'm going to interview Muhammad Ali. They all thought I was BSing them. So what happened was I go down, he takes me in the back, and I knock on the door, and I tell him that, you know, that I'm a student at the newspaper, and he told me to come in. So for 45 minutes, you know, we had a really nice interview. And I went in there thinking he was arrogant and really, you know, very cocky. I came out just loving the man.
Oh, yeah.
I thought he had the most street sense I've ever met of anybody. And we talked about all kinds of things. He joked around a little bit. I remember he was going to fight Joe Bugner. And he said, from all over the world, they send their best to battle Ali in the ultimate test. So merry old England is sending her hero, but against Ali, Bugner's chances are zero.
And he was great.
Yeah, and he was talking about, at the time, there had been a hostage taking on the roof of the Holiday Inn in New Orleans. And he said to me something that was very prophetic, because it was before a lot of this terrorism. He says, when you don't care what happens to you, that's when you're really dangerous.
Yeah, and that's true.
And he was clowning around, and you know, it was sort of like shadow boxing with me. And
yeah.
I came out of there just loving the guy.
Well, I told you my little story. I'm meeting him when I went to a local community college in outside of Gloversville, where I grew up. And this was when he was, I don't know what year that was for you, but he wasn't boxing when he came around and was doing this tour because of the draft thing. But you're right. He was like the nicest guy you ever wanted to meet, and the funniest guy. Nothing like the showmanship that he put on, which was only to draw the audience and get people not to like him so they'd pay to see him get beat. And he was really great.
And I remember, I remember how I ended the article. I basically quoted Howard Cosell, because this was the time where he was going to get ready to fight, I guess, Joe Frazier again. But then what happened was George Foreman knocked him out.
Oh.
So,
okay.
So he did not have the heavyweight championship at that status, and he wasn't sure what was going to happen to him. So he was sort of in. And so I remember quoting Howard Cosell, and I said, anybody who doesn't think that Muhammad Ali is heavyweight champion of the world ought to get in a ring with him and tell him.
Yeah, that's funny. I'll tell you, back then they were great. I mean, Howard Cosell was another one who people used to complain about, but I liked the guy when he was announced. He used to announce everything.
Yeah, he used to do everything. Yep, and they even, he like, if you ever watch like some of these sitcoms, whether it was the Partridge Family.
Yeah, Couple.
He'd be on all those shows.
Yep. Yeah.
And it was funny because I got to meet him twice.
Really?
Yeah. This is sort of an interesting. I have what happened was I used to live in Stamford, Connecticut. And I was going down to New York City, and I get on the train, and it stopped at Mamaroneck. And this guy who I didn't know gets on the train. His name was Michael Kramer. And he had this little girl who was 3 years old. And he's telling me, and it was really crowded, so I sat next to them. He had the little daughter on his lap. And he said, well, we're going down to New York because we're going to close the show Annie. So I said to the little girl, I said, her name is Samantha, do you like the music from Annie? And she said, she shocked me. She goes, I much prefer Nelson Riddle.
Oh.
Now, for those who don't know, Nelson Riddle was probably the greatest arranger of all time.
Oh, yeah.
He was, you know, known mostly for Sinatra, but he also did Ella Fitzgerald, and he did Nat King Cole and Judy Garland, just who's who. So that sort of shocked me. And he ended up being a big, big Sinatra fan, and he had all the bootleg tapes that you know you couldn't find back then. It wasn't like there was an internet or anything, so I had to go over and see him all the time. So what happened was he was the head of the Seals Executive Club in New York City. And they used to have this, it was like people from different companies that they would have a $1 million club, and the top people would all go to this affair. And they would have the big affair every year at the Waldorf Astoria. So one year he invited me to come to it, and there was a pre-party before they went into the Grand Ballroom, and I got to go. It was only 50 people. And you know, some of the people there was Howard Cosell, Yogi Berra, George Steinbrenner, Gene Autry, just a ton of people. And then when I go into the main thing for the, and I'm the only one who's going up to people asking for their autograph. But anyway,
at so that anyway, point, you
I go
weren't
in,
shy
I go
anymore.
And I sit and I look next to me, and I was sitting next to Jimmy Cagney.
Okay. Wow.
I couldn't believe it. So that was like one of the great, exciting moments of my life.
Yeah, that's interesting. Growing up in Johnstown, there was a leather factory that tanned horse hides for Major League Baseballs. And he had cleaned out his warehouse one day, and the Yankees were putting on a clinic. So Yogi Berra, Joe Garagiola, Phil Rizzuto, Monty Irwin, Bob Feller, they all came up and sat on a table in front. And you could go up and either get a baseball or bat, didn't cost anything, and they'd all sign it. And so I brought one of my friend's little kids with me, and he thought he was going to meet Yogi Bear instead of Yogi Berra. But meeting people like that is awesome. And how many people get a chance to do stuff like that? Like, you know, you met a lot more people than I did.
Yeah, I have a great story about Phil Rizzuto. So what happened was, I grew up in New Jersey, and I grew up in a town that had no African-American people. And then they had this teacher who was my greatest teacher of all time. Her name was Gloria Dandy Smith. And she was my journalism advisor as well as my English teacher. And she later on married a football player from the New York Giants. And one day I used to go over in the morning and, you know, hang out with her in her office. And she said to me, do you like the Yankees? And I was a big Mets fan. And I said, no, I hate the Yankees. I'm a Mets fan. She goes, well, that's too bad, because my husband had gotten tickets, had made arrangements for, and I was going to be you, to go to Yankee Stadium and sit in the press box with Phil Rizzuto and call a game. And I was trying every which way to get back in her good graces. And she said, no, I'm going to teach you a lesson. And so what happened was, well, just as an aside, like a year or so later, she wanted to go to Palisades Amusement Park because they were closing it. And on the way home, her car was in a bad accident. She was killed.
Oh, dear.
So going back to the story, a year later, she says to me, do you like the Yankees? And I go, I love the Yankees. And so she taught me a lesson. And so I got to go into and call a game. With Phil Rizzuto, which is really cool.
He was a great guy.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Matter of fact, when he retired, they brought a cow out, remember,
right.
And it stepped on his foot.
And he was known as always like leaving in the sixth inning because he wanted to beat the traffic.
Over the bridge. And people would bring him cannolis in. And what I read, just was reading about him the other day, because he was in with Bill White and Frank Messer.
He always called everybody by their last name.
But one night, he must have been thinking about Bill White, because he said, hello, I'm Bill White. And Bill White's standing next to him, and you can see the clip on. But his daughter had a restaurant in Vermont, and what's where the Equinox Hotel is? That's right.
In Manchester.
And so he used to come through Saratoga, pick up a newspaper, and then, you know, go to Manchester. And so he was in Saratoga whenever he went to see his daughter. And I don't think he stayed to talk to people or anything. But, yeah, he was like the best.
I think he had a daughter who lived in Rensselaer County, too.
Okay. All right. Yeah, he was up a lot. But, you know, that's when announcers were fun too, because that trio was like great. I thought they were the greatest announcers. Well, you had great announcers for the Mets too, though.
Yeah. So I had another story. So I was living in Stamford, Connecticut. I think I mentioned that. And what happened was, I got invited to go to the Jewish holidays at some synagogue, and I'm listening to somebody praying next to me, And I said, that voice is really familiar. And I looked over, and it was Mel Israel Allen.
Oh, Mel Allen.
Mel
wow.
Allen, longtime Yankee Hall of Fame announcer.
Oh, yeah. So Mel Allen was great. He used to do
No, he used to say, how about that?
How about that?
Valentine beer.
Yeah, and he used to do, after he retired now, he used to do This Week in Baseball. Remember
right.
that show on Saturdays?
Yep.
Yeah, he had. They were great times growing up back then. Well, we'll get back to stories. I want to hear some of the things you do, because you, and we'll get into the chips, too, because that's what you're famous for, but you have an article that you write for 518 Magazine.
Yeah, what happened was there's a woman named Stephanie Sitnik, and she used to have a magazine in Connecticut called Inc., I-N-K, and her husband got transferred to Albany. So she started this magazine, and it was called 518 Profiles, and they handed out in most of the shops at the beginning of the month. It's for free, in Saratoga. And the gist of this thing is that it's about people who have some connection to the 518 area, but they're successful. And so she heard about my potato chip stuff, and so she did an interview about me. And in the process of that, as part of my Toga Chip Guy experience, I have a website, but I also have a weekly blog. It's called My View of the World Through the Prism of the Potato Chip.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, you know, she hadn't really lived in or grew up in this area. And most of the writers that she had were people from out of town, a lot of them from Connecticut and other places that she had when she had the previous magazine. And she said, I was trying to help her out. So I said, here's like 10 different stories you could write about different people. And she said, you know, when I was doing some research and background about you, I noticed that I read some of your blogs and you write really well. You know, why don't you come write for me? And I said, I was sort of hesitant. And I said, I'm not really sure I want to do that. I don't want to have deadline pressure, blah, blah, blah. And so she kept asking me, and I asked me like three times. And so she was very persistent. So I said to her, I'll tell you what, I'll do like two stories. And if I like it, then I'll continue to do it. But I don't really like deadline pressure, you know?
Oh,
so,
yeah.
So what happened was the very first story I did was about this woman, Melody Howarth, who basically repairs very ornate ceramics and also restores graves and that. But she does it for a lot of the world-class museums all over the world. And the story just poured out. It was the easiest story I ever wrote. So I enjoyed that. And then when I was in Syracuse, my college roommate had a sister. And she's a very famous artist. Her name is Phyllis Colombo. And what happens is she is very known for her photography. She would go to very remote areas of the world where people couldn't get access, and she would photograph the women, the native women, in their native costumes.
Oh, wow.
And she's put out like 7 books about it. And I had always heard about her from my roommate, but I never knew her. And she has a house up in Rensselaer County on Burden Lake, and so I interviewed her, and that was sort of interesting. So I sort of got into it, and then because I don't like deadline pressure, as I said, one time I said, I'm going to get ahead of this. So I wrote a whole bunch of articles, like 3 articles, and I figured she would space them out, and I wouldn't have to worry about it.
Right.
And she put them all in the next issue.
Oh, geez.
So I said, no, you're defeating the purpose here.
Right. You're trying to set yourself up. I mean, if you wanted to be away for a week, you had an article ready.
So now she doesn't, like, she says that she gets the best feedback on my articles, but it's interesting because in the last year, I wrote 2 of the more interesting articles, I think. The most recent one was about, I'm trying to think, I guess, I did one about Charles Pignon. And Charles Pignon grew up in Latham, and he became, and so he had this story where he was a big Sinatra fan, mostly through his grandfather. And when he was a college kid, wherever Sinatra was performing, whether it would be Providence or Atlantic City, where he could drive, they would go down and see him. And so he became this big fan. And then at one point, there was a lot of different Sinatra fan clubs. And and one of the people who ran one of them passed away. And Frank Jr. told him that, you know, if you want to he told him that you should really take this over. So he took it over, and then Frank Jr. said to him, if you really want to cover the old man, you should come on the road with us. So they brought him all over the world, Japan, all these different places.
Wow.
And he ended up that he now works with Sinatra's youngest daughter, Tina, and a longtime attorney for the Sinatra family. And they run everything, you know, so all the reissues, Sirius satellite radio, all that stuff.
Oh,
he
wow.
does. So it, to me, it was really fantastic because I'm a huge Sinatra fan. And we you know, so I called him up and we were able to do this. And it was one of the more fun things. And then another article I wrote recently, somebody had told me about this guy named Nicholas Fox, who is a person who does a lot of art maritime art, mm-hmm. ships and
oh,
stuff.
Oh, okay.
And I had gone and interviewed a famous artist from here, and at the time, going back to the potato chip industry, there was this company, and the guy who owned the company, he was out in Dayton, Ohio, had asked me if I could write a jingle for him. I never wrote music, but I used to write what they call special material. So if a relative had a birthday or an anniversary, I would take the music of a well-known song and I would make my own special lyrics towards that particular person. So I said, sure, I can. So what I did was I used this song. This was the oldest established, still continuing company that was making potato chips that was still active. So I was thinking about it, and I said, well, I'll take the song from Guys and Dolls, the oldest established floating crap game in New York that was known for, you know, Sinatra singing it. And Len Tantillo, famous artist, I had interviewed him, and I was trying to figure out, you know, how I could get the license for the music. And it ended up that the music was owned by Sir Paul McCartney.
Oh.
So Len says, well, I have this friend, and his father wrote a lot of famous music, and he manages it now, but he's his artist, Nicholas Fox. And so he told me some of the songs that his father had written, such as You Will Be My Music, and there used to be a ballpark here. And so I called him up, and I said, you know, it's interesting to me, because Len told me that your father wrote all these music, and your last name is Fox, and yet the person who wrote all this guy was Joe Raposo. And he said, well, that's my dad. Fox is basically Raposo in Portuguese is Fox.
Oh, really?
So I changed my name because I didn't want to rely on it. But with Joe Raposo, most people don't realize it was Jim Henson's partner. He wrote all the music for the Muppets and Sesame Street. So I ended up writing an article about him. And I've written articles about somebody who writes comic strips, somebody who does murals on the outside, a whole bunch of people now.
Now, and, how long have you been doing this?
I guess it's been about maybe 5 or 6 years.
Oh, wow.
And I have a list of like 30 articles that, you know, she told me I could write. The only one she's ever sort of vetoed was about a famous person, but he committed suicide, and she said that was really the wrong vibe.
Right.
So she didn't want to do that one. But you know, so I write them at my leisure, and I can get a little bit lazy or I get distracted because I have all these other projects. But and it's interesting because I really enjoy the craft of writing. I try to have, because I, you know, going back to my journalism days, I try to have a really eye-grabbing headline, mm-hmm. and then really hook them in. And I always make the comparison to music. So when I think about, like, one of my favorite songs was Vic Damone singing the song that came out of Lerner and Lowe's My Fair Lady, On the Street Where You Live. But he doesn't start with the song. He starts out with the chorus. Oh,
okay.
The fabulous feeling, you know, just to know somehow you were near. And so I write like that. I sort of hooked him right at the beginning with the very best part.
Okay.
And then at the end, I try to write a very clever ending that wraps around and goes back to the beginning.
Yeah.
And
well,
it takes me a long time. I'll be sleeping, and then like at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll wake up and I'll say, "Oh, I could. This is how I can do it." So I labor on it a lot, but
yeah.
I really like, you know, the quality is more important to me.
How many have you written a book?
No, I haven't written a book. A lot of people ask me to write a book about the potato chips, but a friend of mine wrote a book called Crunch, and I don't really know that it could be improved upon. But a lot of people tell me I have a lot of great stories and I should write a book, but I never have.
Yeah, I mean, fascinating stories. You have to remember that you were an attorney, too.
Yeah,
I mean,
I was senior tax counsel for GE, and, I did that for 35 years.
Yeah, and all this other stuff to boot, you know.
Yeah, it was interesting because, like, what happened was people used to tell me that I reminded them of Gilbert Gottfried. And I didn't know if that was a compliment or not, and I should do stand-up. Now, when I started my career, I was in Houston, and I used to have a photographic memory, and I would remember jokes, and I lived in this apartment complex, and there was like 7 swimming pools and all these young people, and every night I would go out to the pool and I would tell jokes for like an hour and have a big audience and that, but they were really not my jokes. And so everybody was telling me this, so then all of a sudden there was a guy named Bill Keller, and he came up for, the comedy club is here, but it used to be down in Albany. And he was teaching people how to do stand-up. And I decided to sign up for the class. It was like 8 weeks, and at the last week you performed. And in the meantime, they would have all these different performers there, and you could meet them because you were allowed to go, and it was right after class and that. So I started writing, and this guy Bill, who's still a good friend of mine, he was the head joke writer for Jay Leno. And he said to me, you're really not getting it. Because I was writing at first very technical legal memos, and then later on writing very concise, advisory emails to people to tell them what they could do or what they couldn't do. And I didn't really understand the essence of comedy. And I remember he said, like Woody Allen always said, it takes like 100 jokes to get one or two good ones.
Yeah.
So he had me stay after class. And I was working with this guy who was a hairdresser. His name was George Henry, but he went by the name of Jenry. It was a contraction of his two names. And he thought he had the greatest act. He had taken the class like 3 or 4 times, but he just thought he had the best act. It couldn't be improved. But he wanted to work with me. So every Monday morning, we would go to the diner, the Gateway Diner in Albany, and he would help me polish my jokes. So I started to get it. And at the end of the thing, it ended up that he had me headline the last show, which, so I had gone from not getting it all
to doing that.
I wanted to prove I could do it. So, so that was, it was sort of fun.
Yeah.
I enjoy doing that.
Just want to interrupt here. You're listening to WSPN 91.1 FM on Skidmore Radio, and the phone number is 518-580-5783, and that'll get you into the studio. And we always welcome phone calls, so break down and give a call. How, from all of this and your law career, what interested you in the potato chip side of your life? Because it seems like you had so much going on, and being a big Sinatra fan and your law career and your writing career, and you're now, I find out that you're a joke comedian to boot, because this is like extensive, your potato chip side.
Yeah, what happened was my wife and I bought a house on Saratoga Lake in 2004, and I was trying to find some artwork of Saratoga Lake to decorate it. And I remember going up to a famous photographer up in Lake George, and I said to him, "Do you have any pictures of Saratoga Lake?" And his response was, "Oh, that puddle." So anyway, what happened was I went over to Michael Dudley had a Riverfront Studios at the time over in Stillwater, in Schuylerville. And he had a woman working for him. And she told me that when they were younger, my house is on the old grounds of Caterers Amusement Park.
Oh, okay.
And she said, I used to take my kids there. And while they were on the rides, I would sketch. So I bought her sketchbook of the park and all the rides. And then she said to me, but I had a boyfriend at the time, and he's still interested in, he still has a lot of art. Now, the boyfriend, you might know him, was the old boyfriend, Michael Noonan. And Michael Noonan was the protege of George Bolster.
Oh, all right.
Now, George Bolster is known as the man who saved the history of Saratoga Springs.
Right.
He was a pretty good photographer in his own right, but more than that, at the time, the two largest hotels in the world were based in Saratoga Springs. And it was a time where, during the Puritan ethic, it was frowned upon to take vacation. So what would happen was all these wealthy people would go to their doctors and they would get prescriptions to come to Saratoga Springs, and they would give them a schedule, walk to this spring. So between walking and drinking all the different water from the different springs, they would get healthy. And then, of course, they would conduct a lot of business at night. And because all the famous people were there, it was really the first place that all the paparazzi was there.
Oh.
So there was like people like Settle and a bunch of other very famous photographers. And they used glass negatives. And so what happened was George Bolster, he bought up all their collections. And it's called the Bolster Collection, which is housed now at the Saratoga History Museum at the casino.
Yeah.
And so I went over to meet Michael, and he had this photography thing where he had all old, like 100-plus-year-old equipment and everything. And he was telling me some of the stories. So he's really the man who got me started on this, and I'll sort of explain. So what happened was, there was a Victorian mansion downtown Saratoga, and it wasn't owned by anybody noteworthy, but they were doing some renovations. And when they were knocking a wall in between it, they found one of these original cardboard boxes of the potato chips. So the Queen of Saratoga, Mary Lou Whitney, evidently got wind of it. And so she called George Bolster up and said, can you come down and take pictures of it, and then we'll recreate it, and I'll give it out as a favor to some of my parties I have every year. Like, she used to have Susan Lucci and
right,
all these famous
yeah,
people
she
come
always had an annual, I think the beginning of the track or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
So what happened was, so he ended up being the one who took all the pictures. And so he had this very large collection that he kept for himself. And later on, he had some issues, and he needed some money. And so I ended up buying them all. And my mother, when I was, you know, being raised, she always said everything in moderation, but I never paid any attention. So I was fascinated by the fact that, you know, he told me where my house was. It's a stone's throw from where Moon's Lake House, which was the purported place where George Crumb supposedly invented the potato chip. And I was really fascinated by the fact that the very first generic name for all potato chips was Saratoga chips.
Okay.
And
I didn't
know
that.
And so I was, you know, it was really amazed to me how that happened, and I was sort of figuring how did it spread, and I looked and nobody had ever written about that, and I said it would be really cool, to write about something that nobody else has ever written about. So I really got into it, and then I got a couple big breaks in my whole thing. So at one point I called Washington D.C. in Arlington. And there was the Snack Food Association, which was the trade association for all potato chips and later on other snacks. And I called down there trying to get information. And if you ever saw the movie The Founder with Michael Keaton, he plays Ray Kroc of McDonald's.
Okay.
And he keeps saying that the persistence is the key for everything. You have to always be persistent. So I was calling other people, like, where I heard they might have some stuff, and they would, like, they'd laugh at the phone. I would say, I'm a potato chip historian, you know, they hang up on you or whatever, but you had to keep calling back. And so I ended up calling the Snack Food Association. They said, well, the man who founded it was a guy named Harvey Noss, and he had a son who's still alive. Harvey's son, Don Noss, is, like, in his mid-80s, and he lives out in Cleveland. And he recently had lost both his wife and his daughter to cancer. So they said he's really in a funk, and it would be a great deed if you called him up, because he loves talking about this, to get him in a good spirit. So I started calling him up, and we had, like, I call it a phone pal instead of a pen pal, where I talked to him all the time. And then he said, well, why don't you come out and to Cleveland? And so I got a hotel near where he lived, and every morning we would get up, and we would drive an hour and a half to these old chippers.
Oh.
And these were people who were in the chip business, and either they were bought out or they had retired, because most of the industry was consolidated. For example, Pepsi, which owns Frito-Lay, owns 70% of the worldwide potato chip market. And so they would talk to me about all these different things, and they saw me as being much younger than them. So there was sort of a handshake agreement, you know, why don't you write about our stories? And I have a section on my website, which is togachipguide.com, called Building an Industry, where I've documented the history of a lot of these companies. And in exchange for that, they gave me all of this memorabilia that never saw the light of day. It was never in the market. Wow. So I ended up starting getting a ton of stuff. And then it was interesting how I said I would call for one of the companies was Lowry's. It's a very high-end steakhouse.
Right.
And they used to also make some other products like frozen food and that. And this particular company, I would call the lady, and I called like six or seven times. And then finally, they would never put me through. And then finally they said, she wants to speak with you. And it ended up that the company had started in 1905 in, or 1915, I guess it was, in LA by selling Saratoga potato chips. And she sent me all the pictures that she had from her personal scrapbooks and everything.
Well, that's pretty neat.
So the culmination, like probably the greatest thing, was that when I turned 65, my wife's family got me tickets to see Steve Martin and Martin Short at Proctor's. And Paul Schaefer was their accompanist. He was the guy who used to be the musical director of David Letterman.
Right.
And he came into the audience and randomly picked me to go up and do the part of Chevy Chase in the Three Amigos dance. So we're on the stage, and Martin Short says to me, what do you do for a living? And I had a lot of friends in the audience in that, and I said, well, I'm a potato chip historian. And Steve Martin just went crazy. He goes, what a coincidence. We had one of you last night. So even when I went back to my seat all night long, he kept making jokes about it. And he was saying that, you know, he said, I can just see it now. Alan's going to be driving home, and he's driving a little bit erratic, and a policeman pulls him over. And after like an hour of smooth talking, Alan just about gets himself out of avoiding a ticket. And then the cop says to him, by the way, what do you do for a living? I'm a potato chip historian. Step out of the car, and he raises his gun. So those are the type of stories. So it's sort of funny from, you know. And, you know, at first everybody just laughed at it, but then it became serious. And then, like this past year, 2025, I had a couple really cool experiences. So I got a call from the French public television, has a show called 66 Minutes. I guess it's inflation.
Right.
It's sort of like 60 Minutes. So they said they wanted to fly over and do a segment because there are people like food, obviously, in France, and they wanted to do a segment on the potato chip. So they did a 29-minute segment about me, and they filmed part of it in my house, and we went over to the Wishing Well, where we made chips from scratch, and we went to a bunch of places in the area. And so that was really cool. And then I did a, this was interesting. There's an independent truck drivers association of the Americas, Canada and the US. And one of their board members had brought them ketchup flavored potato chips, which are really big in Canada, but they don't really sell much. They're not that popular in the States. So they were sort of curious as to why that occurred. So they decided to go on and see if there was, they said there must be some potato chip expert who could explain this, and they found me, and they said, well, how would you like to do a podcast for like an hour? And the truckers listen to this, I guess, when they're out on the road. So if you ever get a distracted trucker, it's probably listening to my presentation. So they called me up, and it was a lot of fun.
That's neat. You know, you talk about one potato chip is sold in Canada and not here. There's the girl I told you from China that I was taking care of here has grew up with a girl in Beijing, and they were best friends over there, and she is going to the University of Toronto. And I had gotten to be friends with her talking on Instagram and stuff, and she loved, you know, the Sun Chips?
Yeah, they're actually owned by Frito-Lay.
Okay. Well, they make all different flavors, and she loved the original flavor, and you can't buy those in Canada. Every other flavor you can buy up there are that. So I bought her four bags of chips. They were only like $1.99 for the big bag, and I shipped them to her, and the shipping was $33. And I said, I told the girl at the window, and I said, I'm spending $33 to send four bags of chips that don't even cost $12. But it's funny how one, I don't know what the reasoning is. If they just don't sell enough?
Well, there a lot of it is cultural and what people's subjective tastes are. And so, like, for example, Lay's, they have this thing as do us a flavor instead of favor. And they have people submit in different countries suggestions for what type of flavors they could use. And then they pick three of them for each country, and then they actually make them.
All right.
So the other big break I got was there was this show on the History Channel, and it's called The Food That Built America. And I didn't know that much about these shows, but they hire somebody who actually produces the show.
Mm-hmm.
Then that producer hires another company who does the research for them. And that research company hires another company to verify the research. So I get a call from the company who verifies the research telling me that they have all this stuff and could I verify whether or not it's true or not. And I found a lot of flaws in it, but anyway, they hired me to go work for them. And then later on, I get a call from the people who produced the show. And I said, are you aware of the fact that I'm working for this company who verifies the research? No, we didn't know. So they said, we're looking for people to come on, you know, on the air. And I said, well, I was an executive with GE and I'm comfortable speaking, so I'd be willing to do it. So they hired me, and then they said, well, we need a second person. So I mentioned a friend of mine had written this book called Crunch. So I called him up. He was the second person. So I go down to Brooklyn, and I really didn't know what to expect. So on a Friday night, it was right before my birthday, which is in February, so it's a few years back. It was right before COVID shut everything down. I taped this thing.
Yeah.
So they send me 100 questions on a Friday night. And they tell me I have to come down Tuesday and we're going to tape Wednesday. And so when I had met Don Noss out in Cleveland, when he passed away, he gave me all of his father's stuff. So I have his Hall of Fame induction from the Snack Food, his desk set, and every magazine that was ever written. So I have an extensive library. So my wife helped me, and we were up like 18 hours a day doing all this research for all this stuff. And I'm thinking I'm going to have to memorize everything. And like, it was like almost studying for the bar exam. I was really nervous about it and have to go down there. So I get down there on Tuesday. I didn't sleep all night because some of the things like the saddle shape of Pringles is a hyperbolic paraboloid. And I kept thinking in my sleep, I'm going to mess it up. And, you know, I was trying to do it. And I was stressing out and sweating in my sleep. So I get down there, and there's a woman who is a reception person. And she says, no, the way it works is that we're going to tape you, like, for 8 hours straight, two cameras, one close-up, one from a distance. And, you know, you just continue it, but you can look at your notes. Like, you don't have to know everything by memory. But I had memorized as much as I could. So once I heard that, I got a little bit more relaxed. And so I had no idea about the power of that show. Because first of all, people who I hadn't seen, like childhood acquaintances and stuff from school, all started contacting me. They saw me on TV. And then when I worked for GE, I did international tax. And so we had like 1,000 people in the tax department all over the world. And so they would put up, you know, Alan Richer, potato chip historian on the screen. And all of a sudden, it would be translated into foreign languages. And you could hear me in English, but they would dub over it in a foreign language and that. And these people who were my former colleagues at General Electric, they would take pictures of the screen and send it to me. So I see it in all these different languages.
That really
put me on the map. Once you had that in your corner, you know, so that really gives you a lot of credibility.
Well, your history, too. I mean, that's amazing just to talk about. I want to talk about one thing. There's another interesting thing about Saratoga chips I want to ask you. But the Chief Rick Stone and Family Foundation, I try to do some research on that. And I'll take a piece and, you know, I can highlight it and copy and paste it to, you know, the Word file, and then I can read it during the week, you know, because I go batty trying to get stuff off the internet to read. But explain to me what that is.
Okay, well, what happened is my mother passed away about 10 years ago, and she was married to my father for a long time. And I didn't really know the story, but I found a bunch of pictures of this gentleman named Clifford Siegel. And my mother actually had been engaged to him before she met my father. And he was from New Jersey, where she grew up. And he went into the Battle of Tarawa, which is in World War II. Mm-hmm. And it was 6 months before D-Day. And it was an invasion in the Pacific of this island of Tarawa. And it was a strategic air base. And so America felt that if they were going to eventually, before the atom bomb, invade Japan, this is something they had to conquer. And the Japanese knew that. So what happened was they planned to invade it. And everything that could go wrong went wrong. And he was killed on the very first day, like minutes after he got off the boat into one of those Higgins boats. And, you know, some of the things that they ended up modifying for D-Day were the fact that each of the soldiers had to carry 150 pounds of equipment.
Yeah.
And then there were reefs and stuff that they couldn't get over with the Higgins boats, and so they were sort of sitting ducks. But eventually, the battle took a lot longer, and Americans finally won it. And so what happened was, I was sort of, when she died, I found this stuff, and I was sort of curious about it. So I started doing a bunch of research, and then I called the missing in action for the Marines. He was in the Marine Corps. It was in Quantico, Virginia, and I talked to the woman who was in charge of it, and she sent me all of his records, including his dental records, his medical records, everything. And so I was really fascinated about this. And so there's a in New Orleans, there's a World War II history museum now, and so they have a library and a research thing. And I had seen that they were going to show video of the battle. Actually, one of the Marines had actually filmed part of it. But both FDR and Truman had said it was too much blood and guts, as it was never shown before. So finally, they decided to show it. So I called them up and I said, you know, I live out of the area. Is there a way that you're going to show it? Maybe in New York would be a little easier for me to go to. And they said, well, actually, somebody's posted it on YouTube. So I got to watch it on that. So as I was doing more research, I came across Chief Rick Stone. Now, Rick had been a police chief in both Hollywood, Florida, and in Dallas, Texas. And later on, he had worked a part of his life in Honolulu. In the the Defense Department has this MIA type of thing where there's thousands of boxes of human remains that have never been identified.
Wow.
And he was a whistleblower to Congress, because Congress funds it to the tune of something like $200 million a year. So they have plenty of resources, but there was no sense of urgency. And he said that their motto was, well, sooner or later, anybody cares about these people will be dead, so it doesn't make a difference. And, you know, that obviously upset him. So he started this foundation with his family. And I think his son is now like an admiral in the Navy. So it's a very well-established, you know, recognized
military
family
for the military
contributions. And so what they had, like, was a rule that for some reason the families had to contact them, but they couldn't contact the families. So what he did was he gave me a bunch of names. So for the Battle of Tarawa, some of these people were local, like in Amsterdam and that. And I had to use like reverse ancestry and try to find the closest nearest still living relative. And this is over 80 years ago. And then once you found them, you know, to tell them how they could send DNA in. And he had done this thing called RISC, and he had developed this system when he worked as the police chief. And it was statistical analysis to say that most likely, you know, this particular person was here. Now, in the case of Clifford Siegel, who was my mother's fiancé, there was some record that after the battle, they had done a makeshift treasure map, and he was buried in some grave. When they went back after the war, they could never find him. So they never found him. So he's memorialized in Punchbowl, which is the Arlington National Cemetery of the Pacific. It's in Honolulu.
Hmm.
And so anyway, So that's how I got involved with it. And then so I started doing all this research, and I found a bunch of people, you know, who had, I found a bunch of relatives, and we got DNA, and it's really nice because, you know, then they get a full military thing. And when you talk to these people, they'll tell you that, you know, their parents, like if it's a sister, died heartbroken, never knowing, you know, having the body returned.
Yeah, closure is an important thing in any way of life, you know. But you talk about D-Day. My father-in-law, they busload of kids when they graduated from high school in Saratoga, it's probably all over the country, went to enlist in the Army. And he got sent to Texas. And he made a mistake and told them that he was allergic, had bad allergies. So they said, okay. They put him on a boat and sent him over to Germany. And he was in the second wave of D-Day. Three got off the ramp at the same time. And one guy on each side of him had their head shot off. He got over and he fell in the water head first. And you said with all that heavy backpack that they had to wear. And by the grace of God, the next guy's down, one of them pulled him out. And of course, and then he went on, you know, to fight and was in the Battle of the Bulge and everything. But there are so many guys that died that way, by falling head first in the water from wearing all that heavy equipment. And it's just, I mean, that's amazing about finding that.
Yeah, so if you Google Chief Rick Stone and family, you'll come up with a thing. And he does this podcast. It's called No Home for Heroes, basically saying the U.S. doesn't really care about bringing their heroes back. And
yeah,
he did one all about my mother and myself and Cliffy.
Oh, that's neat. That's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, I read a little bit about the site, and I'm thinking how to tie it in with potato chips when it's a different side story that you did as far as investigating and doing research on the you know, the remains and stuff.
Yeah, so my mom died, it was just 10 years ago, and she had two different types of cancer, and I had retired. And I went down the last 3 months. I was staying right near where she lived and helping her out. And, you know, so it was fortunate that I was able to do that. And I had remembered a story that when I started my career, I was working in Houston, Texas for Exxon. And I didn't have any place to go for Thanksgiving. And so she told me to go see her friend. And I was remembering all these things. And I was saying, well, who was that woman? And she said, that was Cliffy's sister. So I didn't know that. I mean, I didn't really know all this stuff. But as I did research on Cliffy, I actually found, well, his two sisters had died, but I found that one of his niece and nephew, one became a big doctor in Texas, the other one became like provost of Stanford University.
Oh, wow.
So they were very successful, and I, you know, have a relationship with them now, which is really nice.
Yeah.
And then I felt like, even though I didn't know him, I sort of had this feeling, you know, if things had worked out, maybe he would have been my father. So when I bought a brick at the New Orleans World War II Museum in his
That's
honor.
That's interesting. What they did around here was the military museum had somebody come in for like, it was like weeks, and interviewed veterans. From the Capital District area, you went there and sat down and they interviewed you. And the DVDs are in the museum, but they're also on YouTube. So I go and watch his interview sometimes, you know, and it's really interesting what these people went through and their outlook on things, you know, because a lot of veterans don't like to talk about their experiences.
Yeah, I had an uncle who actually was a paratrooper into D-Day, and he never really talked about it.
No. It's amazing. I don't know if you remember the TV commercials, the Don Equis beer commercials with the most interesting man in the world.
Right.
All right. I think you're going to take the place. You are, like, as far as I'm concerned, the most interesting man in the world because you've got so much experience in different areas that, and I know that the chip side of you is very important. You've got so much memorabilia on that. And I know you're on TV. You've been interviewed by major outlets, and you go around giving presentations. But yeah, you're a fascinating person.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I just did the Irish American Club in Albany last week.
I saw that in the paper.
And so that was sort of exciting.
Yeah.
And then I do a lot of other stuff. I'm on a lot of boards and a bunch of other stuff. But I one of the things I'm working on right now is there's a movie that my boss, GE, is the executive producer on. It's called the Ain't No Back to a Merry-Go-Round. And it has to do with, in suburban Washington, D.C., there was an amusement park called Echo Park, and it was race-restricted. And the movie is about how the Jewish population down there fought to get the restrictions removed. And I've been trying to bring this movie to the Capital Region for over a year and a half now. And recently we had a conversation where it looks like we're going to finally be able to do it with a combination of the Jewish Federation and the Albany Institute of History and Art.
You know, there's, I don't know if you're interested in anything in Saratoga, what the Jewish people went through, but back in the 1800s, there was, I don't know what business that the fellow was in. I know it's in a New York Times article I went back to look at. I mean, Jewish people always came up to Saratoga for the baths and that. And this fella used to bring, I don't know how many train cars for the summer up with all his, you know, his maids and his the people that took care of him and his family. And they came up every year, and they stayed at one of the big hotels, Grand or whatever, the American Hotel on Broadway. And matter of fact, Abraham Lincoln wanted him to be Secretary of the Treasury, and he declined. But he came up to Saratoga one year, and they were starting to unload the car, and somebody came over from the hotel and said, "I'm sorry, we can't host you this year." And they put a ban against Jewish people.
Yeah, there's a museum in Philadelphia. It's the Museum of Jewish Culture. Mm-hmm. It's right by the Liberty Bell in Independence Hall. And they have a whole exhibit about Saratoga. And I think it was Judge Hilton who had led a lot of anti-Semitism.
And yeah. I mean, that's, you know, that's a section that you don't hear about of Saratoga, you know. And I just read that article about him. I don't know if I was reading about Abraham Lincoln, and then that story came up. I mean, for years it was okay, and then, you know, one year he brought everybody up. They never told, of course, they never told him beforehand, because it wasn't today the you can get to anybody either by phone or internet, whatever, you know. Well, we've come to the end of the show, and there's probably still another hour to talk about. And I know, you know, I hope you'll be on again. I always enjoy having you on. And I upload my show to my website, saratogabroadcasting.com, and I also load it up to YouTube. So, you know, people can listen to it later on. Alan, it's just great having you on. And if you want to get a hold of Alan to have him come and, you know, talk about anything, his contact information, his phone is 518-527-6393. And his email address is togachipguy, all one word, at gmail.com. And the website is togachipguy.com. Great stories, great information, things you never knew about potato chips, which goes back over 100 years. And so, you know, thanks for being with me today.